It's not the most welcoming pair of words, but it captures what drives the elixir of economic growth, a question that economists have been trying to answer convincingly for more than two centuries. The word pair is creative destruction. It's not the magic of markets or the simple consequence of investing ever more that drive growth, although both have their place in the story. Rather, the proposition is that the central propellant of economic growth is the act of creating through innovation and ideas new ways of producing goods and services, but which in the process destroy the old, incumbent firms who are producing in ways that are going to become outmoded, hence creative destruction. The more an economy can creatively destroy, the more it will grow. Britain's not great at it, but there are prospects it could get better, as we will explore. The famous economist Joseph Schumpeter first coined the phrase back in the 1940s as describing the essence of capitalism. It has simmered away in the background as other ideas have held economic center stage. But over the last few years, no economist has done more to revive, reconceptualize it, and bring it to the forefront of rigorous economic thinking than Professor Philippe Aguillon. Last autumn, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics for his endeavors, captured in a book that promises to be as influential as Maynard Keynes' General Theory or Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. It's called The Power of Creative Destruction, an eye-opening, forensic, and convincing account of how the process works. It was for his work on creative destruction above all that the Nobel judges cited in his award. A professor at the London School of Economics, Collège de France, and the European Business School, INSEAD, I'm delighted he's with me today, one of my intellectual heroes. Well, thanks for joining us on the We Society. And I've got to start off by saying congratulations on being a Nobel Prize winner. But there was something in the book that really caught my eye. It was in the final kind of paragraphs where you say, capitalism is a spirited horse. It will take you anywhere and get out of control. But if you hold its reins firmly, it will do what we want. Yeah. Does that capture the essence of how you visualize capitalism?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what it is. I mean, it's like AI has the same thing. It's, you know, technological revolutions, you know, sparks the history of capitalism. It's really, those are horses, and then if you get the proper institutions and policies, you can get the best out of them. But of course, if you don't get the appropriate institution and policies, of course, it can produce the worst. So, but they are extremely powerful. All the big industrial revolutions that we've been through, steam engine, and then electricity, and then IT, and now AI, those are kind of big steps in the creative destruction. And I mean, you could get enormous, they brought enormous amount of progress and improvement in our standards of living. But it's true that you can make a good use of them or not such a good use of them. And that it's incumbent on us to set up the right institutions and policies to harness the power of these revolutions, of these innovations.
What I like about, first of all, the notion of creative destruction is obviously captures something. But just listening to that answer, I mean, it's a kind of challenge to both left and right. Because you're saying to the left, you know, you can't socialize this spirited horse. But what you've got to do is to hold the reins firmly and point it in the direction of travel you want to go.
Yeah.
And what you're saying to the right is, for God's sake, stop talking about the magic of markets and the whole thing will find its own place. I've held that position all my career, but it's not easy politically or economically. You've got, because you're attacked from both sides.
It's exactly what happened to me. I mean, I'm attacked on both sides. I mean, it's true, because to the left, I said, you can't deny that we have a European technological decline of Europe nowadays, and we have to do something about it. And we need to, you know, to set out forces that will spur innovation and so that Europe can again be a technological leader. And to the right, I said, you know, don't believe that free market, free laissez-faire will do the job, and that you just have to you know, limit the role of the state to law and order. No, that won't work either. So exactly, when you have this position, which I would say the good social democrat position or gaulliste social, whatever you want to call it in France, you get attacked from both sides, absolutely. The extreme, the right, the ultra-liberal would, you know, would tell you, you know, no need to have any state involvement beyond law and order. And on the left, they would tell you that, you know, providing incentives to capitalists is a bad thing, and that you should be totally egalitarian. So that's.
Before we just leave that, because we're going to dive into an account of creative destruction in the next kind of 10-20 minutes.
Yeah.
But before we leave this, these big picture thoughts. I mean, you just said, you know, you're totally convinced that Europe's got to kind of get its act together in this process that's technologically behind.
It should. I don't say it will.
Yeah, well, it should.
It should.
But it's a very important statement because, it's obvious. And this is the debate in the United Kingdom. To a degree, it's not as, you know, we want economic growth, but actually how you get it is left kind of hanging. You know, is it going to be tax suspended? Is it going to be more free market? Very few people champion creative destruction. And I think it's the same story kind of elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, it seems to me this is a kind of not just an intellectual job that's got to be won in our respective countries, Britain, France, but also in other parts of Europe. But also, it's a collective project. It's got to happen on a European scale. Am I right? Would you agree with that?
At least it's important that key countries in Europe, you know, get their acts together. That's what I believe. I don't believe, you know, Europe, it's 27, 28 countries more. I don't believe, you know, we have to enroll all 28 countries at once. I believe very much in a coalition of the willing, and that coalition of the willing has to include UK, France, Germany, hopefully, and some other countries. And I think they should lead the process. And, you know, we are back to a kind of a Churchillian, Gaullian time. That's where we are. Because the values that we stand for, democracy and freedom, social model, environment, we stand up for some values. And those values are not being defended anywhere else in the world the way they are in Europe. So we have to stand up for those values, exactly the way we had to during the Second World War. And I think we are going through such a moment. And I know I followed what happened in Munich. Rubio said we are together. I mean, of course, we should never close our door to anybody. But I think what's happening now in the US is an irreversible process. I don't think it will revert. I think we should consider that it's a kind of a durable change. It doesn't mean that we are not allies in some ways, but I think Europe has to rely on itself. And when I say Europe, it's primarily UK, France, and Germany. I mean, those three have to get together and really realize that they have to count on themselves first. Then you can make deals with anybody else. But I would include probably Canada, Carney, Mark Carney. I think he made a very forceful speech in Davos. And Carney is with us. He shares the same values as we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would include Mark Carney. And that's the core. You see what I mean? For me, US is no longer part of the core. The core is those who firmly defend the rule of law, democracy, freedom, and that's the core. And then you can make deals with anybody else. But that's my view of things.
Very inspiring. Let's just look at the economic theory and then come back to some of the consequences of what you just said. I tried to spell out in the introduction creative destruction.
Yes.
But I think it'd be best to hear it from you, yes. Actually. Do you want to say in a few words how you see it and how it's so kind of essential to economic growth?
Yeah, I mean, the view is that, you know, growth is driven, by, you know, ideally by having all, you know, a dynamic economy, ideally, is an economy where all the time you have new talents coming in and try new things. And the new talents challenge incumbent interests. And so they are there either to force the incumbents to themselves innovate, to escape the competition with the new talents, or to replace the incumbents. And so creative destruction is really the idea that progress is driven by being constantly challenged by new talents who come up with new ideas. They force you either to innovate yourself, or you just leave the place, you know, and let them come in, and that's so. It's really this constant, you know, movement of new innovators coming in and challenging vested interests. That's really what creative destruction is about, and so you need. It's a world where you need to let talents emerge, grow firms, realize their ambitions. And of course, once they become big, you have to make sure they won't use their rants and their position to prevent subsequent generations of new talents to come in. You see what I mean? So that's a contradiction. You need innovation rants. You need to let talented people grow and get rants from their innovation. But you want to make sure they won't use these rants exposed to prevent subsequent generations of new talents to come in. And that's the big contradiction you have to manage.
That's a major contradiction, but there's many
but
others.
It lies at the heart of the understanding the secular stagnation enigma, understanding the middle income trap, why some countries start growing and then stop growing midway. This contradiction comes up all the time.
I've just finished a trilogy of papers on economic growth called the Growth Trilogy, which were, I have to say, I'm just going to say it to you, you know, sitting in your study here in London, that was inspired, actually, by the notion of creative destruction. And I met, in the course of this work, kind of the founders of new enterprises, who are really inspiring people. I mean, mission-driven, purpose-driven, kind of inclusive in the way they manage their company, work all hours of day and night, because they really believe that their technology will change the world. I mean, they're inspiring people.
Yeah.
And actually, Britain's got a lot of them, and to a degree, and increasingly France, you know, it's not just a British phenomenon. But it's so complicated. I mean, where are they going to get the finance to support their growth? Where are they going to get people to experiment with the goods and services that they're offering? So many of them get taken over either by incumbents or, in our case, in Britain's case, by kind of American private equity companies or American multinationals. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you've got, it's such a delicate process. And then you've got the social fallout that actually, of course, you know, incumbent firms may go to the wall, but they're going to go to the wall and some of the people working for them are going to be made unemployed as a consequence. So this isn't, you know, what you've described, I think when people hear it, they're going to say, yeah, he's onto something. But I think we need to just look at the complexities of it in a bit more detail.
Yeah.
So where do we start?
You need a whole set. That's why I think, it cannot just be pure laissez-faire. You see what I mean? And so the way first is to make sure that talents can emerge. So you need a good education system, you know, with good PISA tests, good reading, math.
PISA is the
scale that measures. You know, the PISA tests are the tests that measure the performance of the education system. Yeah. There could be other test score systems.
Yeah, yeah.
PISA is one. Because
international test score system.
Yeah, and it compares between various countries.
Yeah, yeah.
But you may have other rankings. And it's very important to have a very basic school system where you learn to learn. I think it's very important. People have to learn to be adaptable, because a world of creative destruction is a world where you will have to change jobs many times, and you need to learn to adapt to a new situation. And if you have a good schooling system where you need basic learning, basic reading, reading, writing, calculus, solving problems, concentrating on problems, means not too much AI first at school. There, you learn to learn. I think it's very important. That's the kind of the basis, you see. And then, you know, you need to have an ecosystem where, you know, risk-taking is encouraged, okay? So for research, you need long-term research funding, because you need researchers to take risk. Then when you you create a new firm.
In universities and in companies and also
research foundation, like ESRC, for example, or the European Research Council. For example, the European Research Council that the UK is part of, they finance five-year projects, but maybe they should finance 10-year projects, you see. But that, I think, is very important for risk-taking. Risk-taking, you need to fail. Failure has to be allowed, you see, and for short-term failure to be allowed, you need long-term funding of research. Then when you create a new startup, very important to have business angels and venture capital. There is some venture capital in Europe, not enough compared to the US. We need much more venture capital. Then when you want to encourage risk-taking by young firms, new firms, to encourage risk-taking in larger firms, we need institutional investors, pension funds, mutual funds. You have some in the UK, in Sweden as well. We need to have more of them. That's what I call the ecosystem that will encourage risk-taking at all stages, at research stage, startup, and larger firms. That, I think, is very important. But you also need risk-taking by employees. That's where I believe very much in the flex security system in Denmark. In Denmark, when you lose your job, for 2 years, you get 90% of your salary, and the state retrains you and helps you find a new job. We need to move towards such systems, because then people will do more risk-taking, and it makes creative destruction more efficient. People, firms are able to hire and lay off, but also it makes sure that the laid off can retrain and bounce back into the labor market.
Yeah.
And I think that the flex security, I think, is a very important component. And we need the equivalent of the Defense Advanced Project Agency, the DARPA.
Yeah.
This way that the Americans have found to reconcile industrial policy and competition policy. We don't have anything like the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency in Europe. We try to, but so far we don't. We would be great to have joint French, UK, possibly German DARPAs on defense. We know that we have to invest in defense, very important, possibly on energy transition, energy, and maybe in biotech. Those are areas where France and UK, for example, are very strong, both of them. They should work together and establish this joint DARPA. So you have the whole ecosystem, long-term research funding, good school, good flex security, long-term research funding, the venture capital, the institutional investors, and the DARPA. If we have all those things, then we are in very good shape to become again innovation breakthrough innovators like we used to be in Europe, I think.
That's very it is an inspiring vision, and actually. I just want to go a bit further, kind of exploring what you just described. I mean, you mentioned venture capital kind of in that kind of ecosystem that you want to see.
Yes.
I mean, the third great institution of modern capitalism is being described. I doubt that many of the people kind of listening to this know what the hell we're talking about, venture capital, and what it is, what they do, how important they are, where they get their money from, their role in this process. You might like to explain.
Yeah. So venture capital, sometimes venture capitalists are people who used to be successful, startup firms or new firms, and they went through IPOs, initial public offers,
on public stock market,
and they got they cashed on, and then they used the wealth they accumulated this way to become venture capitalists themselves. So venture capitalists is someone that you want to start
a project. You're describing how that's you're describing the
how you become a venture capitalist.
This is the origination in the States, isn't it?
That's the way in the States. I think it's very good, because I think that there is nothing better than someone who has been herself or himself a startup firm, successful startup firm, to become subsequently a venture capitalist, you see, because what it takes to be a successful, startup. So I suppose I created a firm, I grew my firm, I did an IPO, I sold my firm, and I become very rich, and then I can use my funds to become myself a venture capitalist. That's what several of my friends have gone through that. They've initiated a company, they sold their company, they become rich, and they then became venture capitalist. So what the venture
If I could live my life again, if I could live my life again, that's what I'd like to try to have done. And I encourage people listening here in their 20s or 30s to think in those terms. Yeah.
So then what you do is that you say, well, okay, what does it mean that I become a venture capitalist? I mean, I invest in your firm. Of course, you have no collateral. You have a good idea. So I will ask to get a high share of your profit to start. Of course, you'll be able to reinvest part of your profit to grow, but I want a share of the upside. If you are very successful, I ask for a share of the upside. And also, I have some control rights on you. I can control some of your decisions, make sure you don't do crazy things. And then, as you grow and as you prosper, I relinquish some of my, control rights, and some, and I let you get a higher share of profits. So you see, it's like, it's like a tutor. It's like parents. Parents are very, they pamper you when you are a baby. They're there, and then as you grow up, they relinquish control rights. It's exactly like parenting. It's a parenting, and that's what venture capital is all about.
And importantly, they give the money out in sequentially over time.
Exactly. They relinquish revenue rights and control rights as the firm grows. You see what I mean? And yeah. But at the same time, they let you take risks. You see what I mean? They, of course, not crazy things are there to prevent crazy moves, but they let you, fail in the short run. They bet on you for a while. You see what I mean? That's what like parents would like to choose, to do study this or that, and they would be behind you.
Mm. I mean, I know it's a bit obscure to some listeners, yeah, but I think it's very important. I draw a very important distinction between this kind of financing process you describe, venture capital, and private equity, which is much more about value extraction.
Yeah.
About, flipping companies, financial engineering, loading them with debt,
yeah,
selling them on. It's much more predatory,
yeah,
than this venture capital, which, yeah, is much more about the parenting that,
exactly,
you described.
Yeah.
I don't think people really get that. I mean, but you would agree with that.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, broadly,
probably they don't. Probably
they don't.
And what's very interesting is that, having good institutional investors around also makes it easier to have venture capital. You see what I mean? It goes together. If you develop, for example, Sweden managed to develop, pension funds, even though they don't have a fully funded pension system. And that also favored the emergence of venture capital and the growth of venture capital.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organization behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Interestingly, what you've described, of course, is what the British government is trying to do. I mean, it's talking about trying to build pension super funds with the pensions bill going through.
Uh-huh.
It's trying to build up the British Business Bank and get the British Business Bank to create fund of funds in which these pension funds can invest. The British Business Bank itself takes stakes in company to kind of signal that we've done the due diligence, that's worth supporting. Yeah. Then there's the National Wealth Fund, which does growth equity when they get bigger. I mean, Britain has got, and it's got a very good university system. It's incipiently kind of got an emergent ecosystem of the type you describe. It hasn't got the flexicurity.
No.
But how do you see the British system?
No, I think on the finance, you are more advanced than France is, and I think you are closer to, the type of a financial ecosystem we want to have for foster innovation. So you are ahead of France and maybe another countries in Europe when it comes to the financial ecosystem. On education, I have not followed closely how well you do on PISA tests. That I don't know. I think on flexicurity, other countries are further ahead than you are. And on DARPA, I know that there are some attempts to create the equivalent of DARPA in Britain. But my thing is that the best would be that we have several countries teaming up to get this DARPA, at upscale. And on defense, defense, for example. You are, you know, France and UK can do a lot together on defense. So you have very good research in the UK. You see, you have fantastic scientists. You have very good university system. So you are very good in defense. You are very good in biotech. Very good, you know, the AstraZeneca, but you have very good biotech labs in Britain. So that's why I believe that without Britain, we have no hope of a European recovery.
And vice versa. I mean, I think that the
that's obvious.
It's obvious. I mean, we reciprocally need access to European markets, but the problem access is, to European collaboration, you know.
But the thing is to make sure we are together. See, for example, if you buy, you know, F-35 planes from the US, okay, you know that you're totally in the hands of the US. They can turn off the whole system. You know that. I mean, for example, Denmark, they bought F-35 planes. It means they cannot go to Greenland, to defend Greenland. They cannot, because the US, they can turn off the whole system. They can make the planes totally unable to fly and operate. So it's important that if we decide to have European recovery, with all good, you know, thoughts for US and whatever, we need at some moment to realize that we need to have an autonomous defense system, really autonomous. Is the UK ready to go for that with us, for a truly autonomous defense system? We are part of NATO, and we should not, you know, I'm not in favor of disbanding NATO, but are we ready, you know, together to start doing building things that will make us truly jointly autonomous? Well, that's it's not an obvious move to make.
But it's moving in that direction. You won't know this, and no one else should know, but my father was a deputy permanent secretary of the Ministry of Defence in the 1970s. And he spent under Harold Wilson. And the last, it was a civil servant. And he spent the last 5 years of his career trying to argue just this. Spent a lot of time in Paris trying to get, you know, didn't succeed, obviously.
And the French are tough. And it's not easy to deal with the French. I mean, I'm not there to, of course, with Dassault, with, oh my God. Yeah, absolutely. It's not a piece of cake. Not a piece of cake at all. Yeah.
Let's go back. I mean, so we've discussed venture capital, we've discussed the university system. Flexicurity has kind of keeps bubbling up, you know, in your conversation. I just think it's worthwhile you spelling out why you find that attractive, what its main features are.
The main features is that it, on the one hand, it gives firms the flexibility they need to do creative destruction. You see what I mean? To try new things. And it means that
they could lay people off.
They can lay people off and hire new people. I mean, they should not abuse this, but they can. I mean, it gives them flexibility to do this, okay? And also, it makes it work better, because the question is, what do you do with people who are laid off? Well, they need to bounce back into the labor market. So what the flexicurity system does is that it gives the laid off, you know, income insurance. You see, they say, you know, you will get generous unemployment subsidies, but at the same time, we retrain you. We will find new jobs for you. We will help you find new jobs. If you refuse more than 2 jobs in your qualification, then the unemployment subsidy will start going down. Okay, so everybody is responsible. I mean, the firms, of course, they can lay off and hire. If they abuse the layoff, they have to pay higher premium to the system. They have to pay, you know, it's like polluting more. They have to contribute more to the system. The state is responsible for retraining and help find a new job. And the employees have to be responsible as well to say no, they can't refuse all jobs that are proposed to them. You see what I mean? So it's nice because it puts all 3 parties, firms, the state and employees, with rights and duties. Voilà. That's what I like with it. And also, there have been studies showing that there is no adverse consequence on health in Denmark of losing your job, unlike the US. In the US, Angus Deaton, whom you know, I'm sure, who got Nobel Prize in 2015 with a wonderful friend and scholar, and did his studies in Cambridge, England, you see, it showed that in the US you have the death of despair. Many unskilled middle-aged people, the death rate has gone up a lot because they are their fear becoming unemployed, and they take sleeping pills, they take opioids, they take because they, if you lose your job in the US, you lose a lot, to a large extent, access to good health services.
Yeah, absolutely.
You lose a lot. You lose enormous, quoi. And that's why you have this sharp rise in the death rate of middle-aged unskilled in the US, unlike in Europe, you see, and particularly in Denmark, when there is no adverse consequence on health of losing your job. There's been a study showing that, you know, there is no adverse consequence thanks to the flex security system. Whenever you compare the evolution of, you know, the health dynamics of someone who loses her job to the health dynamics of a similar worker who doesn't lose her job, the treatment group and the control group. And you see that there is no impact of losing your job on the health.
Let's talk about artificial intelligence, because it's very much kind of in the news now, with some researchers resigning from a kind of OpenAI and others because warning about the monster that's being created, that there are some AI tools that now look as though they are simulating human consciousness, and actually we are creating a monster. You don't have to believe that to worry about kind of the impact of automation that it's going to bring on jobs and prospects and accelerate creative destruction. But maybe this time around, it'll be a lot of destruction, but not much creation. What's your view?
I'm not as pessimistic, but again, we go back to the horse parabola that you use at the beginning of our exchange. AI has the potential to generate enormous amount of growth because it will make it easier to produce goods and services, and it makes it easier to produce ideas. You know, new ideas are often recombination of old ideas. So with AI, you can recombine much more, and you can select much, much faster among the ideas you really want to experiment. So it's much easier to innovate. So with AI and without. So ideas will become easier to find. For example, I have colleagues on proofs, you know, of their theorems, you know. Instead of spending 2 days with AI, they spend half an hour, you see what I mean? So it's a fantastic research tool. So AI has potential to generate growth. It also has potential to generate jobs. Why? Because firms that adopt AI become more productive, therefore more competitive, and therefore the world demand for the product goes up, and that makes them hire more. So of course, there is substitution of AI for tasks and possibly for jobs, but there is this productivity effect that I just mentioned, which counteracts the substitution effect. And on top of that, because AI will generate many new ideas are new activities, and that will also be a source of job creation. So there will be job destruction and job creation. How to make sure you make the best of the productivity effect and the new ideas effect? But that's where the schooling and flex security system are so important, you see. So
and
if
how
you
do
have
take, how do you take
and that's again, it's the horse, you see. The that's AI it. Is the good horse. If you have the right education.
It's a spirited horse.
If you have the good education system and good flex security system, and you know how to, then you will maximize the growth, the job creation potential of AI. And
so
if
message,
you don't, you see, that's my way of looking at things.
Yeah, but your message is, as I listen to you, I mean, building on the spirited horse.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence may be the most spirited horse of them all.
Yeah, exactly.
And it makes it much more imperative that the reins are taken.
That's right, exactly.
And,
ridden
in the direction we wanted to go.
That's the message.
That's
more than ever, you need the reins.
So in a sense, your philosophy is kind of dramatized by the arrival of artificial intelligence.
Absolutely,
Do you admire, you obviously don't admire the downsides in America, but you could argue that in many respects, the United States personifies, you know, creative destruction at work. I mean, 25% of world GDP in 1980, 20% of world GDP in 2026. It's an extraordinary story. And they
Absolutely.
They've done it. They just do it, don't they? I mean,
they just do it. I mean, it's true, the US, when it comes to innovation. And, you know, when you look breakthrough innovation in US, they are great. Also, China is becoming good at breakthrough innovation now. If you look at the most innovating companies, the five most innovating firms in the US nowadays, they are not at all the same as 25 years ago. In Europe, they are the same companies, and they are stuck in incremental mid-tech innovations. In the US, they are at the top. They are high-tech breakthrough, and they are not the same as the most innovating companies 25 years ago. So you had much more creative destruction in the US than in Europe. Absolutely. And we need to have more creative destruction in Europe.
And
but the problem in the US is that they don't have the flexicurity. And the problem with that is that those left out of the process, they go for the populist.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? And then you fuel the populist movement. And then you get what you have now, which is what we don't want. You see
vast
what I mean?
Pools
because
of wealth. Vast pools of wealth, distorting information flows through control of the media
exactly.
And all the rest of it.
Exactly. And we don't want that in Europe. Because all those left out of globalization or technological revolution, all those we are not taken care of, they say, well, let's try the one thing we've not tried. And they say, let's try we've not tried them. Why don't we try them? They are desperate. So they say, let's try them. That's terrible. We have to make sure we are inclusive. That's why it's so important. You know, inclusive growth is not a luxury. Making growth inclusive, it's a way to make sure that you won't get populist in power tomorrow. You see that, I think, and that our values that I was mentioning, democracy, freedom, will be preserved. So I think it's very important. When a good education system, you make the economy more innovative because you have many more potential innovators, but you make the economy, the growth more inclusive. If you have a good flexicurity system, you make the economy more innovative because creative destruction works better, but you also make the economy more inclusive and protective. Competition, I didn't mention competition policy, is very important competition. You want to make sure, because it makes sure that new entrants can come in all the time. And new entry, it's a source of creative destruction. But creative destruction is a source of social mobility. So having more competition makes you, again, more innovative and, more inclusive, because it means that new talents can come in. They are not being deterred by incumbent firms. So competition, education, and flexicurity, those three pillars make you more innovative and more inclusive. And they're also those that will allow you to harness AI the best. Because if you have lack competition, the growth potential of AI that I was mentioning before, you won't be able to fully take advantage of, because you will have a few large firms, superstar companies that will, make use of AI to prevent everybody else from coming. It will become crony capitalism. So if you want to prevent that, competition policy is also very important.
There was one bit in your book which I was puzzled by.
Yeah.
Is when you look at the S-curve for who... what children of what parents go on to get patents.
Exactly.
Essentially you're saying that in both Finland and America, it's best to be born in the top 10% of the income distribution, if you want to be an innovator.
Yeah.
I wonder how central that was to your thinking.
It's very important when I said that you need to be inclusive, you have a good education system. It makes you more inclusive, because with a good education system, there is this phenomenon of lost Einsteins or lost Marie Curie. My colleague, Xavier Jaravel, who is a professor here at the LSE, worked a lot on that as well. You see, you have many smart kids born out of poor backgrounds. Their parents cannot transmit the knowledge and aspirations that they should. And so as a result, they don't become innovators as they should. You see what I mean? They don't. So in Finland, it's very interesting. They did in 1970, they made the education system much more inclusive. Everybody, it's a very high quality. They have very good PISA tests in Finland, and education is totally free. And you see, in 1970, they did the big reform. So even in Finland, if you just restrict attention in Finland to those who went to school after, subsequently to the reform of 1970, there you have much less, of social selection. You see what I mean? Because the school system become really much more accessible to everybody and high quality. And then subsequent to 1970, in fact, the number of lost Einsteins was drastically reduced. So if you do a reform, reform like what they did in Finland in 1970 of the education system, you will become more innovative because you will have much less Lowensteins. Many more kids from poorer backgrounds can become inventors, and you will have a more innovative economy as a result, but also more inclusive economy, you see. So that's why exactly my point on education, you know, if you do reform like in Finland, you become more innovative and more inclusive at the same time.
So you can't be a friend then of the British private school system in which money buys education.
That I'm not in favor. Yeah, I'm not for profit schooling. I'm not in favor. I don't believe in for profit schooling. Yeah. I think, you know, then maybe they did other things, and I don't know in detail what has been tried in Britain in the past years. You know, there are various programs, and but I believe in the US, sometimes you have private school, but they're private what we call the charter school, the no-excuse charter schools in the US. They're private in a sense, but they're financed by the law, by the municipality. You see what I mean? It's not,
yeah.
You don't need to be wealthy to put your child in a no-excuse charter school. No-excuse charter school in the US were very successful now in very, you know, disadvantaged areas. And, you know, it's very much discipline, emphasis on basic reading, basic writing, basic calculus, and that worked well, the no-excuse charter schools. That's an example of something which is not totally public, but it's private in a sense that it's the, you know, it's financed locally. That's a good experience, the no-excuse charter. But otherwise, I believe in very much, you know, in Korea, in they have public school system which works well. That you have very basic, you know, in Finland, in Korea, schools with very good PISA tests that really you get a good basis. China, I mean, China did many wrong things, but the education system in China is a good education system.
Just now, I was thinking that whether you were aware that China has their Little Giant program,
yeah,
which is copied directly from American venture capital.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
And what they do is they use state institutions run by the Communist Party for the parenting process.
Yeah.
Intensely competitive, of course.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
So within state structures.
Yeah, but that's interesting. They tried. They. What's interesting with China, I don't advocate the Chinese model. I would not like it because freedom and democracy they don't have. And I'm very attached to freedom. But what they did in China is to still, while keeping the Communist Party in power, they understood that about the ingredients of success of an innovative economy. They understood they needed competition and industrial policy together. And they managed to find a way to have the yardstick competition among firms. You see, when they provide support to some companies, they don't do it to one company. They organize the yardstick competition between several companies. So they found their own way to combine industrial policy, competition policy. Similarly, they really understood it was important to attract researchers of high quality, tenure track. They move into tenure track system they didn't have before, venture capital you mentioned. So what's very interesting with China, they look very closely what works well in the West, and they say, how could we adapt, you know, how could we, you know, import some ingredients of what makes some Western economies very innovative while keeping our system. So that's the game they've been playing so far.
Yeah.
And some people believe, nobody believed that they could go as far while keeping the Communist Party in place. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Some of my colleagues believe they would not even take off. You see what I mean? They believe they would never even be a high growth. And they surprise us how well they are able to,
they have become,
to borrow good ideas from us while keeping the Communist Party system.
It's so paradoxical. They have become, along with the United States, exemplars in creative destruction.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
I was there 2 months ago. They are into creative destruction, and they look very closely at our theory. They you know, when China is one of the countries where our theories are most successful.
That's extraordinary.
It's very paradoxical. Yeah.
Let's kind of round off because we're getting to the end. Now.
Yeah.
In the work that we did in the Growth Trilogy, we established that Palo Alto is, of course, the heart of kind of Silicon Valley in the States, and is the known kind of as the epicenter of innovation, scale-ups, spin-outs, the whole damn thing. But there's a new Palo Alto emerging in Europe. London, Oxford, Cambridge. But the new Palo Alto doesn't just include Britain.
Yeah.
It also includes Paris.
Yeah.
It includes the Dutch, in particular, yeah. Eindhoven, mm-hmm. Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And there are venture capitalists who yeah. are saying,
yeah.
look, we've got to think about...
And it includes Technion in Israel.
Yeah. It doesn't go as far. No, you can't
yeah.
get. You can't get there in 4 hours on a train.
Okay, that's right. Okay, you want to make sure it's within 4 hours. Okay, not fly, but train.
Train is a 4 hour train.
Yes. Okay.
You can jump on a train.
You can jump on a train. Yes.
And do.
Yes. Exactly.
That's the idea.
Okay. Yes.
So that we should do. You know, first of all, hardly anybody knows about this phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, I kind of 20 people, 30 people. I'm hoping more have to listen to this podcast. What are your reactions to this phenomenon?
I'm very hopeful. You see, when I talk about the fact that the wake up of Europe should, you know, feature prominently Britain and France, you just illustrated it again. I mean, you know, Cambridge, Oxford. Paris-Saclay, I guess you had in mind.
Yeah.
That's where things happen in Paris.
There should be one labour market.
We should have a similar regulatory framework. Exactly.
Access to the same
finance.
Forget about Brexit.
We overcome this, and we try to build joint market for high tech. We have very close cooperation between these various centres, university centres. We do venture capital together. We do DARPA together. I think that's the future. That's what we have to do. I'm very hopeful. I like very much this idea of a new Palo Alto multi sites. You see, Palo Alto involving within 4 hours of train rides, and including Cambridge, Oxford, Paris-Saclay. I think it's a very very exciting idea.
It's a very exciting idea.
Absolutely, I'm all for it.
And it could demonstrate to kind of publics in France and Britain that actually. I mean, there's nowhere else to go. I mean, there's nothing else to do.
Exactly.
I don't know how our countries grow without such a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be the old industries. It's not going to be.
Yeah. It's been. Exactly.
It's not going to be minerals, mining, fishing, agriculture.
And already the southeast of England is already high tech.
Yeah.
You know, between London and Paris, you go through southeast of England. North of France is a bit less, more problematic. We need to invest more there. That's not that great. But we'll...
Lille might develop. So we're running off. I mean, to take the opportunity to kind of, you know, spell out, here you are. You know, you've won the Nobel Prize. You know, you've written this extraordinary book. And behind it sits a whole corpus of work over the last 10, 20 years. Where's Philippe Aguillon go next? You know, what do you want to do? I mean, how are you going to use your kind of insights? What do you want to?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm primarily a researcher, so my passion is research. So I want to keep doing my research. You know, I'm interested in the, you know, in green transition and how to reconcile growth and green, the economic and environmental impacts of AI. How to design, pro-innovation policies, R&D subsidies and competition and industrial policy. But all those things we discussed, I'm doing research on them.
It said you had influence on President Macron. He was...
And so I'm very much, the core of my activities is research. And I love to interact with younger people. I mean, they're so much better than I am. And they are absolutely. And interacting with them keeps me alive. I mean, I think that's the basis. I think you die the day you stop doing research. I think it's very important that I keep doing research, and I love research. So that's what I will be doing. So if I can use my prize to contribute with others to make sure that you won't have a populist overtaking in France within next year, I will do everything I can for that.
Professor Aguillon, thank you very much. It's kind of illuminating. I mean, the economics that you've described, but not only the economics, the kind of where it leads and the kind of society that leads, and philosophically and politically where it goes. I mean, you couldn't have been kind of more clear and more passionate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're most welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already,
please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.